Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss why AI is not going to kill us all, why New Zealand has U-turned on its smoking ban, and whether selfies are a public health issue. Hello, and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Say hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom. Hello, listeners.
Very musical today. And we're delighted to be joined, returning to the show, Andrew Orlovsky, who's a Spiked contributor, I'm glad to say, also a columnist at Telegraph Business. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me, Tom.
So, Andrew, the reason we wanted to invite you here was to talk about one of those big issues of our time, supposedly, which is artificial intelligence. Until very recently, it was something that was only really talked about by a few kind of geeks and Silicon Valley types. And yet it's suddenly become supposedly the biggest issue of our time, as I say, that it's either going to accelerate innovation and create all this kind of new interesting technology, or it could be quite literally the end times. You are a very interesting commentator, and you seem to reject almost all of those quite extreme perspectives. So what is it about AI that we're getting wrong?
I think what makes this, well, we're in the third wave over about 70 years, we're in the third wave of expectation for AI and people hoping that computers become these kind of rational, useful decision-making tools. But we're actually 10 years and it's like, well, why not? But, you know, why can't computers think? And that collapsed in the early 70s. The second wave was that largely feared that was a kind of arms race between Japan and America, neither of which kind of had a clue what to do. So that was like trying to take what they'd learned in the first one and put them into sort of simple things like steps a doctor could take to diagnose you. And that didn't work out either. So for that, about 20 years or so, it's been a completely, I mean, if you applied for a job and had AI on it, your CV would just be thrown in the bin. But the current way has been going on about 10 years. It's taken one of the techniques and really ran with it with big machines and big data. But the problem is this approach is always fabricated material. There's a journal in which the AI actually fabricated the entire data set and produced the wrong result. So its capacity for essentially imitating things is there. Well, I think what makes this wave different is that there are so many pundits that want it to work this time. Mm-hmm. I think we have an absolute surfeit of commentators, people in the opinion classes, and then largely not technical. Why would they know it doesn't work? Well, they have no curiosity to finding out why it doesn't, why it may not be working.
No, but I was just wondering to sort of bring it back to some of the big talking points, because this is, as you say, it's got a long history to this, something that many of us weren't really paying attention to, if we're honest, until we sort of had to. But for instance, you take something like ChatGPT, which has obviously become a big focus of discussion, largely because it's a great thing where journalists can hop on there and play around with it and talk about how impressed they were that it managed to mirror their writing style or produce an essay for them that made half a bit of sense. But you've talked about how really, in a sense, this is just a sort of it's a sort of performing gadget, really, and not much more than that. Yeah. Do you want to explain what you mean by that? Because people will see this and think it's taking in all this information. It can write a history essay if I ask it to. Why is it so unimpressive, as far as you're concerned?
There was a desperation to shove something out the door about a year ago, because there were a lot of articles in 2022 saying, look, we've been 10 years into this hype. When's something useful going to appear from it? Because otherwise it's a novelty automation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fun. And there are very boring kind of backroom processes, things in computing that it does, that it's actually quite useful for. The example being cleaning up old footage. I think it's fantastic. It upscales it and turns it into a 4K video. So, you know, when you have everyone running out of the factory, knocking the lemonade stand over in 1890, you can now see that like it's a modern Hollywood film. I quite like that. But the pundit class was saying, well, this is the fourth industrial revolution. You know, it was a vehicle for them to speculate on. The problem is it simply ingests a load of material and produces a copy of it. The idea that it's kind of useful for decision-making is pretty ridiculous. So in a sense, we've got something that, well, let me wind back a step. A year, it was really shoved out the door as a result of interest rates going up. Mm-hmm. And investors were getting very kind of, all their hopes had been dashed, one after another, crypto, Web3, all this BS. And they were just get something out the door. And it is impressive. I think when you look at it, you kind of go, give me another verse of I Am the Walrus, and it'll kind of have a go. It's a bit crap. It's fun. But we've essentially got a tool that doesn't do anything useful but produces lots of what we don't want.
More articles.
Waffle and poor articles, poor artwork, very derivative. What else is it good at? Oh, well, obviously fraud and spam.
And there was that great example of, was it a... using it to try and construct, was it legal cases, or where actually just ChatGPT or whatever tool was being used managed to just invent a bunch of rulings which didn't actually exist? Are there any more kind of examples like that?
There's the example with fabricating entire data sets. There was one last week where Bing reported in The Guardian, if you ask it, does Australia exist? It says, no, it doesn't. Made up. And, so I've tried it with birds. Are birds real? And Bing actually says birds aren't real. I better explain this, because it's a parody conspiracy theory, which goes that birds were sort of all killed off by the deep state in 1969. And the ones we're seeing are just, they're just like little robots which are spying on us. Bing can't tell that it's a conspiracy theory, let alone a parody conspiracy theory. So it just goes, birds are real. It's just a word completion engine.
That's incredible, because it's hoovering up information from the internet, and it can't distinguish that between an entry on like the Encyclopedia Britannica or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there's a wonderful debate where, I mean, it's one of the sort of great bits of humanist sort of debate that takes place in 1972. You can see this on YouTube, and it's where this great Professor Lighthill kills off the first generation of AI, and he's up there with the guy who invented the term, which is essentially a marketing term. John McCarthy, and this is broadcast live on BBC Two on a kind of sweltering night. And Lighthill makes the point, you just want to believe in magic, don't you? And I think that's the driving thing behind the intelligentsia being obsessed with it. They want to believe it. I mean, look at productivity. It's really hard to improve. And they just want this kind of magical solution to come along. I'll be honest, I've not had so much fun writing than I have in the past year, and I've been kind of collecting utopian batshit nonsense, particularly related to AI and Silicon Valley cults, Californian cults for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And there's almost a biblical or sort of fable-like quality to the story of a machine that fools people, but it fools the people who think they're the cleverest.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a Hans Christian Andersen story. If you look below the line on almost any AI story, certainly mine at the Telegraph has spiked, you'll have people who've tried it and they've gone, it's told me to eat glass. it's told me there have been four US female presidents. It will tell, and you know, the public is far smarter about this than the intelligentsia.
So definitely not good for replacing GPs anytime soon if they're scribing glass and things like this.
It's a question that bugs me is, why do you want a computer to do this? That they already do loads of amazing things and they can do more amazing things. And kind of what we want is more efficient robotics rather than sort of just decision-making thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a little list. Do you want an AI to set interest rates, either of you?
No.
Would you be happy with that? No. What about a medical diagnosis if you had a choice of a consultant or a really good AI?
Well, I think that, well, it's not even AI. That can just literally just be done by a robot. Right, you got a checklist of symptoms. That's all GP's using, really, is a mental checklist of symptoms, some of which they get wrong or forgotten about.
Mm.
A computer, I think, could do a better job. I think we can aim for making doctors unemployed, which would be fantastic. Consultants have just gritted a new deal with the government. Yeah. Some of the best paid people in the public sector managing to get.
I love it that you instantly see strike breaking potential in, you know.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
Or strike avoiding potential.
Right. Well, it can drive
in true IA fashion.
It can surely drive trains. I haven't got a lot of faith in AI, but again, it's robots. Because driving trains, as far as I can see, is just pressing start.
Well, you see,
I
know what you mean, because a GP is essentially doing a triage to make you go away. It's the first point. And they've perfected it as well. They essentially don't even pick up the phones. You don't go any further. And you shouldn't go, you know, they try the hardest so you don't get past a GP. But I would rather see a consultant, to be honest, even one who's been reluctantly dragged off a golf course, as most of them have.
Sure, but we can get rid of GPs. We can agree on that. And GP receptionists.
How about, would you want an AI teaching your kids, or would you want a really good teacher?
Yeah, you want a teacher in that situation, surely, Chris? Or do you want to make them unemployed as well for political reasons?
I do want to
reasons?
Make them unemployed, but I only buy a publishing school.
And then you get to the kind of professional mafia, like, where there's a resistance to it. So no lawyer is going to object. No lawyer is going to accept a contract written by an AI.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, so you've got this mutual standoff. There may well be far more lawyers and paralegals than we need. And it's a cost to business, but I don't think they will. You need a human in the loop a lot of the time, which is the problem with self-driving cars, essentially. Mm. You can't program it to kill somebody, whereas we kind of expect drivers at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is a very real risk.
Well, Andrew, I contacted him a few months ago, wasn't it? But the Telegraph asked me to write an article about self-driving cars.
Oh, right. How did
and, that? Well, they didn't publish most of it because the stuff that I wanted to say, which I thought was interesting, they thought was potentially libelous.
You've got to explain more there.
Well, it's just I rang up Andrew and said, can you tell me about these self-driving cars? Because the story was that a new Ford Mustang, I think, had come out, but you had to keep your eyes on the road in order to drive this self-driving car. And there was a camera in the car that was looking at your eyes. And if you took your eyes off the road, the car would stop.
Right? Which sort of defeats the purpose.
It completely defeats the purpose of it, right? Yeah. Along with the fact that you can't drink and drive in these self-driving cars.
Again.
Which is the real purpose.
Exactly.
Of it, right?
Yeah.
So the whole thing's completely pointless. And I asked Andrew, why is this? Why do you have to keep your eyes on the road? And he said, because basically they keep crashing into first responders.
Mm.
They see, well, not all of them, to be clear. But Tesla 3, this is not libelous, this is on the public record, isn't it? Yeah. Tesla 3 has, on several occasions, crashed into anything with a flashing light, because for some reason they're just drawn towards flashing lights. And so they keep crashing into ambulances and fire engines and police cars.
Yeah.
And so they're not 100%. There might be 99.5% perfect, but that 0.5% with millions of miles being driven means a lot of accidents.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think you were saying, Andrew, correct me if I'm wrong, you were saying they're probably never going to be able to
get all the way to 100%. You can get to 70% really quickly, and then you can get to 99% pretty quickly. But that last little bit is always going to effectively require human control, in which case there's no point to the bloody thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the lessons we've learned, $100 billion has been spent on self-driving cars, and getting to that last 5 or 10%, in other words, doing it safely is the hard part. And that's because the environment they're in is so hazardous and random. Stick a tractor in a field, it will be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, the DLR here is a robot. It doesn't have a human driver, which is a great saving in efficiency. You've got, I don't know how many people are in that control room up there, but you might have 3 or 4 or 5 rather than 30. Mm-hmm. So that's a step forward. Again, it's like, why do we need, and why did they think they could do it? I think it's just that kind of Silicon Valley hubris. Oh, we've done this with this, therefore this will be easy.
Yeah. And also, as you suggest, there are certain things that it would be nice to free human beings up to do, or things that you would only want human beings to do, certainly at this particular juncture. But there has been this belief that it was just only a matter of time before they could be writing screenplays as well as, you know, diagnosing you. Do you think there's an element of an underestimate, a kind of underestimate of how different and great a human mind slash human being?
Well, this was Lighthill's point when he sort of put the torch to the first wave of artificial intelligence, which is now nostalgically called good old fashioned AI or GoFi. He just said, I mean, I've got the quote here actually because it's so brilliant. I thought I'd bring it with me. There's something in most of our minds that wants us to believe it's there, referring to that kind of belief in magic. And people will be disappointed when they hear it isn't. This is Lighthill. Right, really, they should be encouraged by the uniqueness of man and the uniqueness of the human race and of human brains, how well we affect and relate to so quickly with other human beings, and the powerful gifts of reasoning over so many different areas. I've always found an uncanny parallel between people who really want to believe in magic. I think it's fundamentally a religious belief that this computer will become alive. And people with a very sort of materialist view who really deprecate human abilities, you know, socially and individually. I think always been a streak of misanthropy in AI.
But this was
nerds who don't like people, basically.
This was mostly what the Hollywood actors' strike and the Hollywood writers' strike was about, wasn't it? The fear of AI taking their jobs.
Yeah,
you haven't got a lot of faith in your own abilities, have you? It's totally unproven.
You can't beat the chatbot, is it?
Well, I think
there's been CGI for ages. It's like Roger Rabbit came out 35 years ago with animated characters taking humans' jobs, potentially.
Mm. I mean, if it was more reliable, I would appreciate something that did research for me, pulled in things from different resources, maybe you know, maybe condense the material.
ChatGPT could probably sort of do that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really intelligent. That's what gets me about it. There's no intelligence to it. It's just summarizing things. ChatGPT is quite impressive in the same way that sort of Alexa is impressive. Mm. But it's not intelligent. There's no intelligence there at all, artificial or otherwise.
And
it's just knowledge and scouring the internet and summarizing, which is cool. But it's not a threat to anyone's job.
Yeah. I mean, you could get a much better research tool just if Google or whoever licensed stuff and built a business around that. Mm-hmm. Because most of the good stuff or useful stuff is not scrapable.
Yeah.
Which is, again, a problem for the chatbots as well. Mm-hmm. They've run out of stuff to scrape. So they are now scraping their own effluence, which I think is a wonderful phenomenon. In other words, they're ingesting, they're being trained on their own output. And I think we all know how terrible how this is going to work out. It's called model collapse, and it's very kind of like Orborus, where the snake eats its own tail. Mm-hmm.
And they'd trouble them, as we've already suggested, spitting out nonsense before this anyway, this whole idea of them hallucinating, which is a phrase that you hear them saying. But Andrew, even though we wanted to talk in the round about this issue, because it's such an interesting one, we should probably, before we move on, just ask about what you made about the goings on at OpenAI, which is many people wouldn't have been again aware of until the last couple of weeks. But is this kind of company startup / NGO, which has been at the forefront of AI, of course, they were in the process of trying to get rid of their CEO, this guy called Sam Altman, and he's now kind of been brought back with the boar's tail between their legs. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, and what do you think that that strange moment revealed, if anything, about the whole AI?
Basically? Yeah, I was quite tickled by this character, Sam Altman, being described as the Oppenheimer of artificial intelligence. And I think the other one, it was in the Independent, the Albert Einstein of artificial intelligence. It may come as a surprise that he's never written a line of code, I believe, since he was about 12. He's a biz dev guy, and he's cherished. And Paul Graham, the venture capitalist, said, "What we love about Sam is how well he manipulates people." That was a great insight into how they do things. I don't think it's a terribly important story, but it was really useful for the various cults and two competing rationalist cults knocking seven shades out of crap out of each other. Because OpenAI was kind of set up as a quasi-open lab NGO-type operation, then needed some money. So it left this kind of oddball rationalist cult in charge of everything, and they've been having absolutely hysterical. I mean, I think there's a mass hysteria about artificial intelligence now, with the Terminator AI just around the corner. So they got the wobbles and got rid of Altman, but of course he's the big, he's the big superstar. So he was back in about a couple of days.
Completely, Chris. Anything more to add on AI before we move on to some of the nanny state issues? Any more questions you got about?
No.
Various unionized workforces.
I'm with Andrew. I'm very skeptical about it.
We should definitely have you back on in the future to talk about it, because it's not going anywhere as an issue, bizarrely. But Chris, should we turn to some of the nanny state stories that
you
picked out?
Why not?
Let's start with New Zealand.
Yes, please.
Because
good news at last.
Given the fact that we've been talking a lot in recent weeks about Rishi Sunak's New Zealand style plan for smoking prohibition. The originator, the New Zealand smoking prohibition, which again was going to be this kind of escalator to getting rid of cigarettes so that a child born on a certain date would never legally be able to buy them, whereas someone born the day after would. New Zealand have abandoned this. So they had the election, the Labour Party was pushed out of office. There's now a conservative-led coalition which have got rid of the policy. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this and what you think it might mean for us over here?
Yeah. Bit of good news every now and again, every year or two, there's a bit of good news, and this is this year's good news after a very bleak year, I have to say. So, so they've got centre right coalition, three parties. The National Party is the biggest one, and they're providing the Prime Minister. And then there's ACT, which is kind of libertarian-ish, and there's New Zealand First, which is kind of described as populist, but also centrist, and also right wing, and also left wing. So, I'm not quite sure exactly what their angle is. Anyway, they weren't happy about this this ban and nor were ACT. And so they got rid of it. Now, it bears repeating because most of the British media seem still to be unaware of this. Mm-hmm. The sliding lid of tobacco purchase was only one part of the New Zealand model, and in fact, not actually the most important part. The other parts of it were that they were going to reduce the number of tobacco outlets by 90%.
Lord.
Overnight. Yeah. What could go wrong? And they were, most importantly, going to take the nicotine out of cigarettes, or nearly all the nicotine out of cigarettes.
Just the tar.
It would just leave the tar. This is the good stuff. Yeah. Wow. And they were going to do that in 2025. So before this sinking lid could even have any effect. Mm-hmm. So that was a real prohibition. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the coalition subsequently said that this was to allow them to make tax cuts because they get about $1 billion in tobacco duty revenue. I don't know if that's a real reason or what. It's not a great look now because obviously the health group's going, oh, you're letting people die just for the sake of tax cuts and so on. But still, it's all good stuff. I hope they have the stones to push it through and the deep state doesn't get to them. But
Doesn't bode well for us, do you think?
Not really, no, because Rishi Sunak said he's going to do it come what may. If he needs to carry the torch for Jacinda Ardern's stupid policies, he's prepared to do it. I still don't understand why he's doing this. I don't know why he's getting himself into this.
Is there any hope in, because I read your piece in the Critic about this, there seem to be some noises in, I can't remember if it's New Zealand or Malaysia, where this was also
Malaysia,
about the fact that this is less the nicotine thing, but the escalator to prohibition. There is a question here about whether or not that will pass muster with a lot of, say, constitutional courts in various countries, because the fact that you are discriminating on the basis of age.
Very clearly.
And explicitly. Is that a concern that something could be challenged here over that basis? Do you
think? Yeah, I mean, I think it is. The Equality Act, which I'm no great fan of.
Rise to the rescue in this instance.
Could rise to the rescue. Yeah, because, I mean, it explicitly mentions age discrimination in there. Mm. This is, like, the whole point of it is to be age discrimination. But then maybe they'll just say, well, we'll ban it for everyone then.
Force their hand,
that's
yeah.
That's the way it ought to go, yeah. So we think we've got them on a sticky wicket, and they'll just go, no, well, okay, we'll ban it. We'll ban it across the board, which is what they'll do, let's face it, within a few years. It's only going to take a couple of years, really, for the absurdities of this to kick in. And then anti-smoking groups will go, oh, let's have a level playing field. They love a level playing field, don't they? And they'll say, we'll ban it for everybody.
Where did the idea come from? Because it's just...
It's been floating around for quite a while. It's been around for about 10 years. The original, I think Singapore were at one point looking at doing it when they were at the point where, oh, we're going to make anybody born in the 21st century never buy cigarettes. Sure, yeah. So there was kind of a neatness to it. Like, it'd be quite easy to remember. Mm-hmm. So if you're born from 2000 onwards, you'd never be able to buy cigarettes. But nobody ever did it in time for that to actually kick in by 2018. So they've had to push it back. But it's been around for a while as part of what they call the end game strategy of tobacco control, which rather I mean, it does rather support people's suspicion that prohibition has always been the end game, if you will. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's got any chance of actually being implemented, Andrew? Is it the sort of thing that you think this is too grand a mission, too absurd a policy to actually pass?
I think the Public Health Party could well be in power in a year's time with an enormous majority. I would expect not just this, but all kinds of craziness coming down the pipe from public health officials. It strikes me as odd because smoking has more or less died out already. I mean, you've got the packaging, everything's covered up. You just hardly ever, you really don't see many people smoking.
But there is still 6 million smokers.
6 million smokers, right.
Plus a load of social smokers who don't admit to it, I would say. Tom's a smoker.
Yeah. Yeah,
not just everyone that's back to smoke.
I'm more concerned. In fact. I'm more concerned about the knee-jerk response to vaping, to making vaping, and what I use the heated tobacco products. I think.
Yeah, given that as well.
Given how deranged the public health lobby is, I expect those will be swept under the.
It is. It's in the.
Even though that's.
It's in the consultation. They are consultation. When they say tobacco, they don't just mean cigarettes. In New Zealand, actually, they were only going to do cigarettes. In the UK, the consultation document says the intention is to ban cigarettes, pipe tobacco, cigars, snuff, because that's very popular with kids. Yep. They need to make sure they get hands on snuff.
They love it.
Heated tobacco and the icing on the cake, cigarette papers. So maybe the pot smoking community might want to respond to that consultation, perhaps.
A very hard group of people to organise, I think.
Well, yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah, true.
It's all that old joke about why weed legalisation people never actually make any headways because they tended to.
Well, they have made a headway, though, haven't they? It's getting legalised all around the world. It's the smokers who can't organise.
It's the exception that explodes the rule. But there's still been no response from the pro cannabis groups to this. Because that's one thing that I know you've been kind of keeping tabs on is whether or not they'll actually wake up and realise that they're not. Well, they don't exist in a vacuum as an issue.
Voltfast have been quite good, but Transform, which is the main one. Did we talk about this before? I can't remember.
Maybe we have.
Transform like officially want to legalise all drugs, including, you know, cocaine and ketamine and so on.
Just not tabs.
But they're in favour of this ban. Because, you know, oh, people will still be able to use e-cigarettes and stuff like this. You know, these people are not liberals. They're just...
Yeah. There is a John Waters movie where he tries to rally everybody to support, you know, free speech and censorship. Oh, I can't remember the name of it, but he tries to rally the stoners, and it's like, oh, yeah, they're completely useless as a political active political.
Well, yeah, my public choice theory would say that it is very hard to mobilise large groups of consumers who are going to be somehow disadvantaged by the policies of a small concentrated interest group. The small concentrated interest group here are the likes of Action on Smoking Health, who you could fit into a phone box, don't get enough donations from the public to employ a single person, let alone, you know, run an office in a campaign. But although there's millions of smokers, their individual incentives to act, you know, are the costs of acting are greater than the the benefits are going to get. And also there's a free rider problem, right? Which is that you've already got Forrest, who on a shoestring kind of try and speak up for the smoker. And so people think, well, there's already a, you know, a pro-smoking, pro-choice lobby out there. I'll just free ride on that. What we really need is a mass movement, but it's never going to happen. It doesn't happen in this area or any other area, which is why small groups of fanatics keep winning. It's a real flaw in the democratic system, really, that you have small groups of fanatics. And the only way to stop it is to stop funding the fanatics, right? Because they're not getting money from the public because the public have even less incentive to fund paternalistic pressure groups than individual smokers and drinkers have to get together and defend their interests. They wouldn't exist at all were it not for state funding.
Vapers did okay about, I mean, they got, kind of got
they did mobilize a bit when it came to the EU. Yeah, on the EU thing, they did. That is true. That was, I think, because they were inspired by the same kind of zealotry that a lot of ex-smokers have, I think. But yeah, they did. Good on them.
I think that one thing is different this time, though, and this is why I'm kind of worried about vapes, is that very often an industry has to get its act together to fend off the state. So it kind of does a self-regulatory thing. I mean, the media's done it, had to do it many times, really, to stop state intervention, formal state intervention. And that happened with the vapors, say, 2015, was it?
Around that time, yeah.
Around that time. It hasn't happened with the disposables, and that's been catastrophic to the vaping cause. I mean, they are a public nuisance. Everyone's got, knows their children or friends of their children. It's, oh, yeah, everyone's doing it in the school bogs. The supply chain looks a bit different now. I think vape shops had a real interest. They were spreading the word. They were campaigning. Suppliers had this focus that time. Self-regulation kind of hasn't happened now, and until the state just goes, wow, here's our chance, we're gonna not just ban the ones people think are a nuisance or regulate those, although as Chris often says, trading standards already have the powers to do it. I think they see it as an opening to take a lot of other nicotine substitutes out of the market as well.
Certainly seems to be going that way. And Chris, I want to get to our postbag section. Before we do that, should we talk briefly about this gambling story? So they've discovered a load more problem gamblers than they thought existed
a lot more
beforehand. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, this is a story. It was in The Guardian last week that there are 8 times more problem gamblers than previously suspected, even though we've been measuring problem gambling for the best part of 25 years. And the problem gambling prevalence has always been around about 0.5%, been remarkably consistent actually throughout that whole period. A couple of years ago, a YouGov survey came out commissioned by some of the anti-gambling groups, saying that actually there's something like 3% of the population are problem gamblers. And that caused a bit of a stir, and The Guardian reported that there may be 9 times as many problem gamblers than we thought we were. This new survey is from the Gambling Commission, which has taken a bit of an anti-gambling turn in the last couple of years under its new CEO, and they report a 2.5% prevalence rate, which is obviously a lot more than the 0.4% that's been reported in the health survey for England. So normally we use the health survey for England every year or two. That's supported by Gambling Commission survey, telephone survey of 4,000 people every quarter. And again, the figures are remarkably consistent at around the 0.3, 0.4, 0.5 mark. And the reason why the Gambling Commission survey reports a much higher figure is, I think, quite interesting, maybe for slightly nerdy reasons, but I think it is quite interesting. It's primarily an online survey, whereas the Health Survey for England is a face-to-face survey, and the Gambling Commission one is a telephone survey, so you actually speak to somebody. The gambling one is predominantly online. What isn't online is by post, so either way, you're not speaking to somebody. And there are several reasons why online surveys in particular get a higher rate of problem gambling. And it all comes down to people refusing to take the survey, basically. So the Health Survey for England, most people, more than 50% of people who are asked to take part in it, say yes. The Gambling Commission one, it seems to be about 20%. The online one is about 20%. So you've got a huge number of people who are just not participating. Why wouldn't they participate? Is there a difference between the type of people who would participate, people who wouldn't? Of course there is. One of the big differences, the people who gamble a lot are more likely to take a survey about gambling. Right? If you say, will you take a survey about gambling, people who gamble a lot, which obviously includes problem gamblers, are much more likely to say yes than people who don't gamble at all or don't have any kind of gambling problem. Also, just being online means that you're more likely to reach problem gamblers. You're less likely to reach old people, and old people are less likely to be problem gamblers. There's basically various reasons, various good, proven, you know, acknowledged reasons why online gambling surveys will always find a lot more problem gamblers than the what is considered the gold standard of the face-to-face health survey for England. However, despite these flaws being well known to the Gambling Commission and everybody in gambling research, the commission has said that they are going to use this survey from now on. It's going to replace the health survey for England.
Naturally.
So straight away, we have got a problem appearing to be much, much worse than we thought it was, much worse than it actually is in practice. And this, of course, will be used as an excuse for more anti-gambling regulation.
Definitely, we will keep an eye on that. We should do more on gambling at some point, because it's certainly coming over the hill as the next one they're going to go absolutely crazy about. Should we do some questions from our postbag section?
Yes, please.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
Always a pleasure to hear from the listeners.
So this is where our listeners can send in questions, either to Chris, also to our guest. We've got one here from Paul Butterworth, which I'm hoping you'll help explain to me as well, Andrew. So he's, although there's a lot of scaremongering and hype around AI, which currently has neither the ability nor the means to threaten humanity, do you think the conceptual threat of the paperclip phenomenon is impossible or just way too far in the future to worry about? And I'm reliably told here that the paperclip problem is that even when AI is designed to perform a seemingly harmless task, it still has the capacity to pose an existential risk to humanity. So tell me if I've got that wrong. But
I think you've described it very accurately, but it's a completely preposterous scenario.
Where's the paperclips come into it, firstly?
I believe that you sort of, somebody lets an AI allocate economic resources and it decides to make loads of paperclips.
Oh, I see. Right.
And I mean, the example I use for these kind of garden shed, too much cider scenarios is that it's, even if we had a much better AI than we do, it's not going to happen because we're not going to deploy it in such a, because of the liabilities, and we like suing each other and we like putting somebody in prison when things go wrong. We're not going to reach a situation where we do that. The analogy I like is, look, if an airline strapped a monkey behind the controls of a plane and the plane crashed, you wouldn't blame the monkey. You'd blame the airline or whoever put it in that situation. So it's just not going to be, you know, Terminator AI isn't going to be deployed. This is what I mean by a mass hysteria. And the last piece I did for Spiked, which came out, I think, on Sunday, I described the effect of altruism cults as a bit of a cross between QAnon and Mensa. And it was actually Adam Curtis who had this brilliant insight into QAnon, that it came out of online gaming where people kind of jostle. It's like an intellectual sort of exercise where the more creative you are with your batshit interpretation of the theory, you kind of, the higher you go up in the social rankings. Well, effective altruism is basically that. And that's why we've got this situation of kind of very clever people running around like children who've seen a ghost or think they've seen a ghost.
And effective altruists, we should say, are very much, you know, at the top of firms like OpenAI, Silicon Valley, a lot are in and around government FTX. As well. FTX.
Well,
we all know how that one turned up. But it's,
They hijacked the summit. When apparently the story goes like this, like Sunak had this choice of various subjects he could do, of which Britain had a kind of lead. Space was one. Semiconductors is another, because there are semiconductors we make that are absolutely fantastic compound. People object to the word microchip because they're kind of little components, but it's phenomenal. It's kind of the result of our chemistry boffins producing incredible stuff that isn't silicon as the conductor, but it's, you know, your iPhone's got them. It's why they conduct heat, they conduct power and light, basically. So he could have done chips. He could have done space, where we've got, I mean, I write about this stuff. We've got incredible kind of boffins. The supply chain for lots of other parts of the private space industry we do. But no, he chose AI, where sort of deep mind said, look at us, we're great. and it dismissed the risk of existential problems with AI in four words in March. But this was completely taken over by around four or five bodies that are related to effective altruism. The people guiding and designing the summit turned it entirely into existential risk. And so poor old Sunak in June, he was, had to make this extraordinary statement that he was, A, worried about Terminator AI killing us all, but then saying, nobody should worry about it. And she's like, well, what are you actually saying? And they were kind of shamed. There was some brilliant reporting, I think, at Politico, which kind of documented this. Funnily enough, this sort of weird cult has also got given the Labour Party loads of money. So they've got a researcher in Wes Streeting's office. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be one of the strangest things, I think, when historians look back at the sort of intellectual trends of now, is how this could just push an open door and, you know, the door just completely comes off its hinges. Mm-hmm. How can you get supposedly well-educated people in our administrative political class, media as well, just going, yeah, we're all going to be wiped out. And the chatbot's going, eat glass, eat glass.
It's a brilliant image to sum it up. There's also a question here, which is about selfies becoming a public health problem. So people have apparently been putting themselves at risk and in some cases even dying to get a picture in front of landmarks and beauty spots. How long before the government introduces minimum selfie distance regulations, Chris?
I hope they don't. I mean, it's like Darwin Award territory.
Yeah.
People killing themselves doing selfies is absolutely fine with me.
There we go. That's one solution to it. I also just want to give a shout out to Maurice Neville, who I'm told hasn't asked a question as such, but apparently on the Facebook comments of every single post-bag call-out we do always insults the lineup. And this week he's called us a trio of dopes. Just wanted to say hello to Maurice there.
Probably not a listener, but that sounds good.
No, I'm intrigued to find out if he responds at all. What level of troll is he? How committed is he?
Say that to our faces.
before we go, I just want to ask your final question, Andrew, which I'm not sure if we've had you on since we introduced this question, so maybe you've heard it before. But if you had one ban, what would it be? We've started doing this with our guests. Because of the fact we're generally very anti-ban, we like to have just a little corner at the end where we can talk about something which...
Petty,
authoritarian, nothing too pious, Chris's peeves, wheelie suitcases. Wow. We've had recently people wanting...
another one, actually. Can I give another one?
Please do, just while Andrew is thinking. Do you want to tell us what you're...
It's another luggage-related one. and that is people bringing on more than one bag onto aeroplanes. Because nowadays, everybody brings a big bag onto aeroplanes, don't they? Because they don't want to put it in the hold. Fine, I get that. But it should still be one piece of hand luggage. I don't accept that most of these bits of luggage people take on are hand luggage in any meaningful sense. I think they're taking the piss and using the biggest bag they possibly can. But that's all right, so long as it's your only bag. Mm-hmm. You cannot bring on other bags. And that includes handbags, little backpacks, anything. It should be that one bag alone, and the authorities should clamp down on anyone who tries to bring any other bag on.
The lower the scale of, you know, the budget airlines are pretty hard line on that stuff.
They're not cheap. Not when it comes to two bags, though, I notice. They're quite hardcore about the size of the bag.
Got you.
But not about someone just draping another bag over their shoulder.
So you want to crack down on those people?
One piece of hand luggage. Do I stutter? One piece. Come on. So that kind of thing, Andrew.
Yeah. And just so if you had, something is of a similar level of pettiness and fury.
Pettiness, well, I mean, I don't know. You've got entirely non-productive sectors of the economy which cause, I think, immense harm and distress.
See, that's too pie. That's too I do want to hear this, but at the same time, you've got to pick.
And I'm kind of thinking the theatre industry has had a really good run. Do we really need any? So Loveys would be my...
New plays? What are you saying? All plays?
Or Loveys theaters? In general. Just get rid of the Loveys.
I mean, look, you could have a nice little five.
Theatres, actors and plays all going in.
Yeah, turn them into Wetherspoons.
A whole fleet of wonderful Wetherspoons in the West End.
Can you imagine?
£1.49 in Newcastle. I was in Newcastle a couple of weeks ago. That's a Ruddles, £1.49.
Yeah.
That'd it's a charity, that
place. I'd make that the mainstay of my Dash for Growth as well, or at least Dash for the Pub.
That's a perfect point to end on. Andrew, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.